In der Nacht vom 8. November 1960 geht eine der engsten Präsidentschaftswahlen Amerikas zu Ende. Nach einem engen Kopf-an-Kopf-Rennen richtet sich der republikanische Präsidentschaftskandidat und amtierende Vizepräsident Richard Nixon an seine Unterstützer.
If the present trend continues, Senator Kennedy will be the next president of the United States.
Die Menge ist aufgebracht und protestiert lautstark gegen den Wahlsieg des jungen Demokraten John F. Kennedy. Kennedy gewinnt eine klare Mehrheit im Electoral College. Tatsächlich liegt er aber nur etwa 100.000 Stimmen vor Nixon. Die Wahl könnte also nicht enger sein. Nixon hatte seinen Unterstützern damals Folgendes zu sagen.
And I want to say that one of the great features of America is that we have political contests, that they are very hard fought, as this one is hard fought, and once the decision is made, we unite behind the man who is elected. I want all of you to know.
Statt zu protestieren, gratuliert er Kennedy zum Sieg in einer demokratischen Wahl.
I want Senator Kennedy to know, and I want all of you to know that certainly, if this trend does continue and he does become our next president, that he will have my whole heart.
Trotz protestierender Unterstützer möchte Nixon ein Zeichen für Demokratie setzen.
My friend, I have great faith about the future of this country. I have great faith that our people, Republicans, Democrats alike, will unite behind our next president in seeing that America, in seeing that they will unite behind our next president in seeing that America does meet the challenge which destiny has placed upon us. And that challenge is to give the leadership to the whole world, which will produce a world in which all men can have what we have in the United States. Freedom, independence, the right to live in peace with our neighbors. And so with that,
in der Wahlnacht am 8. November 1960 gab sich also der Republikaner Nixon ohne weiteres dem Demokraten Kennedy geschlagen. Wichtiger als der Wahlsieg waren Nixon die amerikanischen Ideale. Frieden, Unabhängigkeit und das friedliche Zusammenleben aller Amerikaner. 64 Jahre später, im Jahr 2024, werden die Amerikaner erneut zur Wahlurne gerufen. Hören wir nun einmal, wie man sich heute auf diese Wahl vorbereitet.
In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
And those of you who are familiar with it know that in America, democracy is hypocrisy.
Gesellschaften verändern sich. Und wir reden darüber. Mit Gästen aus Politik, Wissenschaft und aus der Gesellschaft. Heute haben wir eine ganz besondere Folge für euch vorbereitet. Genau gesagt sind es gleich zwei Folgen. Und in diesen Folgen möchten wir mit zwei besonderen Gästen über den Zustand unserer Demokratie sprechen. Unser erster Gast kam dafür sogar aus Washington nach Leipzig geflogen. Und damit willkommen zur Atlantic Hour. Was hier nach einem aufgeregten Treffen klingt, war auch eins. Am 20. Oktober hatten wir nämlich David Frum bei uns im Institut zu Gast. Frum schreibt für den Atlantic und ist ein gefragter amerikanischer Politikexperte. Obwohl er selbst Republikaner ist, gilt Frum als einer der einflussreichsten Kritiker des ehemaligen Präsidenten Trump. Über die Hinterlassenschaft dessen Präsidentschaft hat er zum Beispiel zwei Bücher geschrieben. Wie ihr vielleicht bereits gehört habt, hatten wir ebenfalls noch andere Teilnehmer im Raum. Und zwar unsere German American School Outreach Fellows. Also junge Amerikanerinnen und Amerikaner, die als englische Sprachassistenten für uns in ostdeutschen Klassenzimmern mit verschiedenen Workshops und Projekten den Austausch zwischen hier und den USA fördern. Die heutige Folge wird vor allem aus einem Gespräch zwischen Frum und unseren School Outreach Fellows bestehen. In unserem Gespräch geht es um Populismus, politische Polarisierung und vor allem darum, wie sich die Perspektiven auf unsere demokratische Weltordnung in den letzten Jahrzehnten verändert hat. Frum bringt dabei eine ganz besondere Perspektive mit. Als Redenschreiber des ehemaligen Präsidenten George W. Bush war Frum nämlich am 11. September im Weißen Haus, als die Terrorangriffe das ganze Land in Schockstarre versetzten.
I wanted to see the world from the other side, and so I did that for 2 years. I was in the White House on the day of 9/11 and was evacuated. All right, we can talk about that a little bit. It was a total, I'll say one thing about that. That was a total chaos. And this gives you a sense, it's an interesting thing, this gives you a sense of how things, how time passes. So 9/11, which is now a long time ago, was a dozen years after the end of the Cold War. Really, the Soviet Union doesn't come to an end until 1991, so it's 10 years since the end of the Cold War. Through the Cold War, the United States had extensively planned for a disaster affecting the White House. But the disaster they had in mind was a Soviet decapitation strike aimed at the president. And they had a very good plan for that, which was they had both, the ideal plan was you got the president in Air Force One and got him up in the air. There's also a nuclear hardened command structure below the White House with room for about 10, 11 people. The other things too, there are other facilities. But the whole disaster planning took for granted the disaster was one that would leave most of the White House staff dead, vaporized. So that which would be sad, but you didn't have to think, well, what do we do with these people after the disaster? And at the end of the Cold War, no one had ever thought about a plan that leaves everyone alive? That leaves the White House empty, but everyone alive. So we were all milling around in downtown Washington. And I think one of the only silver linings to terrible events is they make you appreciate the wisdom of your parents and grandparents and what they went through. So, I find the European Union a very romantic idea. I know that's out of style, but I mean, it's bureaucratic, it's annoying, it's full of all these petty rules. And only if you remember what the first half of the 20th century was like, can you see the magnificence of this vision and what it means. And yes, boy, that's a lot of paperwork. But it's also true, there's peace between Germany and France. There's peace between Germany and Poland. People can move around without hindrance. I mean, it's an inspiring thing. And all of that was originally paid for. They're now paying for it themselves, but settling those wars. And I keep saying, Donald Trump used to complain about the Allies that don't do enough. It's not a defect of the international order that Germany doesn't have an army and Japan doesn't have a navy. That was the plan. That was the plan. You know, you guys, you focus on what you're good at, which is not fighting wars, and we'll bring you the peace. We'll deliver the peace and security that you tried to get by aggression, you can get by cooperation. We'll provide it. And in return, you develop these extraordinary societies that are amazing. And here in the former East, I mean, what this place was like, what it is now. Now, it's only had 30 years of the peace that West Germany got 75 years of. It's always very moving to me to come back and see, because people focus, understandably, it's human nature to focus on our disappointments in life and to take for granted the achievements, but the achievements here are stupendous. And maybe as one of the things that those of us who visit and those of us who are temporary residents here can do is just remind people of what it used to be like compared to what it's like now, even if they have complaints, which of course they do. Who doesn't? Okay, I don't have. I've got formal remarks for later. Let's just have a conversation.
Frum erinnert uns daran, neben politischen Diskussionen nicht die positiven Entwicklungen des letzten Jahrhunderts zu vergessen. Gerade in Europa hat sich seit dem Ende des Zweiten Weltkriegs und dem Kalten Krieg danach vieles zum Positiven geändert. Nun stellt sich natürlich die Frage, wenn es angeblich so viele positive Entwicklungen gibt, Wieso kehren sich dann so viele Menschen ab von demokratischen Institutionen und wenden sich populistischen Bewegungen zu? Und das nicht nur in Europa und den USA, sondern scheinbar überall auf der Welt. Und im Vordergrund steht die Frage, was bedeutet Populismus überhaupt?
Populism isn't popular. You put it up for a double choice, a binary choice, they lose. And the Polish elections, so the essence of what we call populism, we need a different word. And the reason it's both so destructive, but also that populism works by redefining, not by making, because they have 50% plus one of the group. They do it by redefining who is part of the denominator and who is not. Well, Trump won a majority of the popular vote if you don't count California. Okay. We don't count California. Okay, very good. Trump won black Americans if you don't count those who live in cities. I'm making this part up, but you don't count those who live in cities. Oh, okay. So we're just going to take like big parts of our people and say, you don't count. And we represent a majority of the people who count. And that's the thing you always need to understand. We represent a majority of the people who count, but we have our own private definition that large parts of our people don't count. That's telling that he thinks, I can't win an election where everyone who used to be qualified to vote. So, I mean, the point of populism, it's a lie. And it's a lie upon lie upon lie. It's a lie of blaming people for things that aren't their fault. It's a lie of promising people things that they can't have. And even still, I just point out, Trump lost the popular, not only did he lose the popular vote in 2016, but if you take every election since the year 2000, there's six so far, and there's made two major party candidates, there are 12. And you stack them by the share of the vote the major party candidate got. At the bottom is poor John McCain, who made the mistake of running in the as a Republican in the middle of the worst economic disaster since the Great Depression and the worst foreign policy disaster since Vietnam. And both of them blamable on his party, and he's a Republican, so he did worse. Second worst Trump, third worst Trump. Everyone else who actually lost got more. Romney got more of the vote, Kerry got more of the vote, Al Gore got a lot more of the vote, Hillary Clinton, of course, got more of the vote. Then they proceed to lose the House. Trump's party loses the House of Representatives in 2018. Then it proceeds to lose the presidential again in 2020. Then it proceeds to lose the Senate in 2021. And then it proceeds to have the worst in the election 22. Well, it picks up the House of Representatives. It has generally, up and down the ballot, the worst result in an off year for the out party since the 1930s. So, the voters are saying something. They say, you don't speak for us. They won't hear it because, yes, if you do it without California, then it's different. So I think that's my answer. And generally, democracy to be sustained always works through institutions. You get on the plane, if the pilot came out and said, okay, who thinks I should press the red button, and who thinks I should press the yellow button? Let's have a show of hands. We pay you, you run the plane. And then we are going to focus on here, and we'll turn on the Wi-Fi, and we do what each of us does. And most of the time, the democracy depends, both creates and depends upon vast systems of trust. This is, I think, the answer to the crowd who say you should do your own research on things, that the more sophisticated and successful your society, the less of your own research you have to do. I mean, if I live in New York in 1885, I'm going to have to do a lot of research about what's in my jar of pickles. Is there ground grass there, rat parts? I have to do a lot of research. Today, I go to the store, buy pickles, and I'm 100% certain there's not ground glass or rat parts in it. So I pay the Food and Drug Administration to do the research for me. And so through area after area of life, same thing with the planes. So the institutions are part of the democratic system, and anyone who tells you otherwise, they rely on institutions of their own all the time. They're just out for power, for bad ends, and they tell a lot of lies together. Anyway, sorry.
At the conservative CPAC conference this weekend, an eruption of lies about the insurrection, making it sound like a bedtime story rather than an event that injured law enforcement and shook the foundations of democracy, literally. Lies. Repeated, aggressive, intentional, dangerous lies.
Populistische Bewegungen sind also nicht unbedingt popular, also die beliebtesten. Vielmehr präsentieren sie ein verzerrtes Bild davon, wer Teil der Gemeinschaft ist und wer nicht. Deshalb wirkt sich Populismus so destabilisierend auf gemeinschaftlichen Zusammenhalt aus. Sowohl in den USA als auch hier in Deutschland sehen wir, wie Populismus zu politischer Polarisierung führt. Im US-amerikanischen Kontext wird die extreme Polarisierung heute vor allem auf einen Mann zurückgeführt, auf Donald J. Trump. Und damit auf den Mann, der als Antwort auf eine verlorene Wahl die demokratischen Institutionen seines Landes außer Kraft heben wollte. Als Trump-Kenner wollten wir von David Frum wissen, wie sich das politische Vermächtnis Trumps einordnen lässt.
I think Trump's I don't want to say he did absolutely nothing good, because there are some legacies, there are some accomplishments. He got the vaccines out faster, incredibly fast. He didn't understand why it happened, and he didn't personally take credit for it. They developed these vaccines at incredible speed, and that's a real accomplishment. I can go through other. I think the Space Force was a good idea. But what his main legacies are, the rehabilitation of violence and the rhetoric of violence is an acceptable tool of politics. Just today, the people who are against Jim Jordan are complaining that they are receiving these death threats by people who know a lot about them. And the pro-Jim Jordan people are saying, oh, don't be such a baby. Everyone gets death threats. Well, everyone did not used to get death threats. Journalists get, it's just different. So the normalization of violence. And the second was refusal to play by the rules of the political system. And one of the things, again, if you're ever on YouTube, this is something I really do recommend you watch, just to get what things used to be like. So in the election of 1960, Richard Nixon faces John F. Kennedy. Richard Nixon is, of course, the vice president, and he loses, and so he is in the uncomfortable situation of, for the first time since the 19th century, of having to preside over the thing that Mike Pence was supposed to do. Richard Nixon does it in 1960. And it's on YouTube. You can watch him presiding over the count. And in a very contested election where Nixon had many legitimate grievances, more legitimate than Trump's grievances, Nixon has to pronounce that John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson are elected. And then after it's over, he says, may I ask permission to make a personal, because it's an unusual situation, to make a personal remark. And he does this heartfelt 2-minute speech about this is what America is all about, that I willingly read the news of my own defeat and the election of my opponent, and then I ask, us all to make it unanimous. That's how things used to be all the time. Somebody made a clip of the concession speeches of every defeated presidential candidate, going back, I think, to Barry Goldwater, and it always happens. It always happens, and that stopped. And he's taught bad manners and bad customs. That is really spread. And one of the great questions for 2024 is, can we put a caesura to that era and say that's behind us, and violence is delegitimated, and you have to accept the results?
Wir hören also immer wieder das Gleiche.
In order to make America great and glorious again.
Great and glorious, great and glorious, great and glorious,
great and glorious. Great and glorious again.
I am tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
Seit 2016 wirbt Trump damit, die USA wieder groß zu machen. Make America great again. Oder kurz MAGA. Hinter diesem Slogan steht vor allem ein Versprechen, die Zeit zurückzudrehen und zu einem traditionellen Wertesystem zurückzukehren. Sowohl in Sachen amerikanischer Innenpolitik als auch im Verhältnis der USA zu anderen Staaten. Als Vorbild sehen MAGA-Republicans die 1980er Jahre unter Reagan, die als eine Art amerikanische Blütezeit verklärt werden. Doch wie uns Frum erklärt, ist der Blick zurück nicht immer unbedingt der Weg nach vorne.
But you don't bring back old conditions. I mean, the party of Reagan was based on demographic and ideological factors that just don't exist. I mean, politics is a business of finding collective answers to collective questions. And since the questions change, the answers have to change. And it's no good saying, I was right about this. Here are the correct answers to the problems of 1979. Let's do them today. that's not going to be successful. I mean, the lesson to take from Reagan is not that he said or stood for things that are applicable today, because except for the highest level of generality, they're really probably not. What you can take from him is that Reagan was able to act like a president of all the people. That he just made it clear the whole country was his constituency, whether people had voted for him or not. And there was just this sunshine about him where he could, he drained a lot of the venom and bitterness from politics because he was so obviously not a venomous person. I think, by the way, it sort of helped him that he was so terribly nearsighted, because he would go into, and soft contact lenses only come along about halfway through his presidency. So his choices were hard contact lenses, which are really uncomfortable, wear glasses, which he was too vain to do, or just walk into a room and just project goodwill. You have no idea who you're talking to. So treat them all like they're people you like. You never know. But he just had, that was his magic. And that magic became stronger and stronger. But I don't think Reagan-style politics, I mean, there are elements. I mean, yes, markets, trade, high level of generality. But the particular things he was trying to do, the Soviet Union is gone. The nature of the competition with China is so different from the competition with the Soviet Union. And you just can't take Cold War politics and reapply them to China. The partnerships you have to work with are very different kinds of partnerships. It's just, I don't think those are the things. I think one of the things, and I say this as someone who has his own share of nostalgia for Reagan, is the reason people like me don't become successful politicians is because people like me think analytically about politics, whereas great politicians are more like artists than they are like analysts. They actually can't explain how they do it. They intuit the way, and they see, like a great artist looks out that window and sees the walls and the leaves, and then sees something that no human being has ever seen before in the way that those walls and leaves can be arranged. When politicians do that, they see new possibilities. And they are very connected with how people feel rather than how they think. And Reagan had all those qualities. Obama had them too. Roosevelt was the paramount example, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Somebody will come along who does those things too. I think that one of the things that Biden really has is he's not a hater at all. That's the thing you can see about him. He's just not a hater. And that the last president of whom, the elder Bush was not a hater, the last president, Reagan was like that. I think the other presidents had a more normal human emotion. I mean, Bill Clinton kept a grudge, George W. Bush kept a grudge, Hillary Clinton was a ferocious hater. Trump, of course, is a pathological person. But that sense of, like, there's a story, probably semi-apocryphal, about Franklin Roosevelt. And I'll spare you the bill if it makes the story too long, but the punchline is that the senior leader of the party is telling him he has to drop his hostile attitude to somebody. And Roosevelt is saying, are you telling me the president of the United States can't have one teeny weeny little personal grudge? And the party leaders say, no, Mr. President, not even one.
Und damit kommen wir zum Ende des ersten Gesprächs über den Zustand unserer Demokratie. Seid auch in der nächsten Folge wieder mit dabei, wenn wir mit Therese Mager vom Leipziger Forschungsinstitut Gesellschaftlicher Zusammenhalt sprechen. Therese moderierte für uns eine Podiumsdiskussion mit Frum, als er hier war, und wird davon berichten, welche Fallstricke es in Diskussionen über Populismus zu beachten gibt. Die Atlantic Hour ist eine Produktion des Deutsch-Amerikanischen Instituts Sachsen mit Musik von mir, Christoph Nostitz. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal.